This is the Stamfords podcast at the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival at Destinations in Olympia.
Ladies and gentlemen, Leveson Wood.
Thank you.
The latest book is called Arabia, A Journey Through the Heart of the Middle East. We know, I've sat on this stage with you before and we've talked about how you do what you do, why you do what you do, and what it feels like. Can we start from a slightly different angle today about how journeys have their genesis, where the seed of the idea comes from, and then what goes on before the third pint in the pub when the idea seems like a great one, and the first step when you buy the plane ticket, all those months of planning. What can you give us an insight into how difficult, especially with a journey like this, across so many countries, so many difficult political situations, visa requirements, health and safety requirements, all that sort of stuff?
Well, this journey in particular was probably the most difficult of all the ones that I've done in recent times to organise, to get funding, to get access into these countries, and generally just to get together. So much so that, you know, my other journeys have been sort of funded by television, commissioned, and had the backing of a major TV channel. This one, nobody wanted to touch it with a barge pole because of where it is. It's the Middle East, therefore that's current affairs news. We don't go there otherwise. And that's the kind of mentality. This is the stereotype of a region which tends to be in the news for all the wrong reasons. I travelled across the Middle East a number of times in a former life, you know.
As a soldier?
As a soldier, just travelling around as a backpacker. I mean, I first went to the region back in 2003, which was, of course, the infamous year of the Iraq invasion. Yeah. I went on holiday with a mate to Egypt to do some backpacking around. Due to some political circumstances and a couple of bombs going off, it meant that I was stuck in Israel with no way out because they were sealing the borders off. And to cut a very long story short, I ended up hitchhiking to the only border which was open with Jordan, which was Iraq. So I found myself in Baghdad in 2003 in the summer, at the end of the sort of war phase of the operation, but very much as the insurgency was about to begin.
And you found yourself there as a backpacker?
As a backpacker. It's very funny because I got a message on Twitter the other day from a journalist called Martin Geisler, who's the ITV correspondent. And I actually bumped into Martin Geisler in 2003. At the Palestine Hotel, which is where all the journalists used to stay. This was when it had the roof blown off because an American tank commander decided that he wanted to shoot the top of the hotel. But I rocked up there as a 21-year-old backpacker, bumped into Martin, and he said, "You know, who are you, you idiot? What on earth are you doing?" Which was a fair response. I explained that we'd had to take a bit of a detour, and he offered to... We couldn't afford to stay in the hotel, so he offered to put me up in the spare room. So it was an interesting summer's holiday, and went back to university with some tales to tell. But I'd not seen Martin Geisler since 2003, and then he sent me a tweet yesterday saying, "Who gave you permission to put my name in the book?" So, but he was good about it.
Sure.
But that really inspired me to want to go back, having been there since over the last 15 years in many guises, to see how the region's changed, to see. You know, has it changed? You know, in the wake of the Arab Spring 2011, with all of the stuff that we see on the news about ISIS and Al-Qaeda and all this. So for me, it's the most interesting, fascinating region of the world. As a historian, I find it fascinating. And what I really thought was we need to look at it through a different lens. We need to see this region other than bombs going off and wars happening. Of course, there's no smoke without fire. There's lots of conflict going on, but there's more to it than that.
So how do you go about planning it? I mean, how do you go about applying for the visas, working out which way around to travel, how to travel, who's going to guide you? I mean, all these things have to be talked about.
They do. I mean, this took 2 years of intense planning.
Oh, really?
There was no money behind it, so I just got me and two mates, basically, who I'd worked with in the past, ex-army guys. We thought we were in as good a position as anyone to do this with our sort of military contacts in the region, so... we all chipped in and made it happen. Lots of the countries you have to apply for visas in advance. Places like Iraq, you simply can't just turn up at Baghdad airport, especially when we had to sneak across the Syrian border. But ultimately, you know, some places like Yemen, they don't issue visas. Saudi Arabia,
do they not?
They don't, funny enough. Saudi Arabia, they weren't in the business of giving out tourist visas. So again, we had to just start the journey and hope that along the way things we could convince enough people and just pull in as many strings as possible from any corner, and that's kind of how we did it.
I'm going to give you a clue how complicated this journey was for Lev, and I don't wish to embarrass you, but I'm going to try to tease some information out of you. The book is 338 pages long. There are quite a few pages of acknowledgements, but there's a very gnomic line hidden in the acknowledgements, which goes like this. I would like to humbly thank His Royal Highness, the Prince of Wales, for his sage advice before embarking. Now, on the assurance that nobody here is going to tweet it, what did he say?
It was bizarre. So I had a photography exhibition at the Royal Arcade on Pall Mall, and I think he must have been driving past and sent one of his, you know, his equerry in to see, because he must have seen one of the photographs.
Right.
And I was on my lunch break at the time, so I wasn't around. But he left his card and said it was just a blank card saying call this number.
Right.
Clarence House. I was like, okay. So I called this number, and he said, well, His Royal Highness would like to meet with you. So I said, of course. You know, next Tuesday, perhaps. It took 18 months before there was a slot in his diary, which is fair enough. But eventually I turned up. And embarrassingly, I have to say, I was 30 minutes late because I got stuck on the tube. But he was waiting for me and didn't boot me out, thankfully. But no, we got chatting, and he asked me what my next project was, and I told him that I was going to do this journey. And what was quite funny was he said, his first question was, are you going to Yemen? And I said, I'd love to go to Yemen, but obviously the situation there is very fluid, and I don't know whether I'll be able to get in. And he said, come on, man, you're a paratrooper. Of course you can get in. which gave me some inspiration.
And a bit of a challenge.
And he also said that, you know, he said, I'd love to go to Yemen myself, but the buggers in health and safety won't let me, which I think is, you know, sums it up nicely. So for me, that kind of set the bar high. I knew that I had to get into these places. For me, this was a really important journey, for lots of reasons. But for me, I think it was just there's a real enigma about the Middle East. And on the one hand, there's this romantic notion of Arabia. I mean, I've deliberately called this book Arabia, which is quite a controversial thing to do, and I knew it would probably garner some criticism, which is fine. But ultimately, it was my own romantic, you know, reading Lawrence of Arabia's book from when I was a kid, and reading about people like Thesiger, Freya Stock, and these greats of Arabian exploration. Of course, we live in very different times now, but I wanted to interweave the history of the region, the legacy of the explorers, but also the legacy of the people in the region now, and look all the way back to, you know, ancient Sumeria and Mesopotamia, and try and weave all of these strands to understand myself what is Arabia and what is Arabia today.
Okay, well, let's start talking about the book. So how did you chart your route? What was your starting point? Which direction did you decide to travel and why?
So I thought I was going to do a big circle,
starting
in northeastern Syria, on the edge of Turkey, so up in the Kurdish highlands. So I had to basically sneak into Syria first off, a town called Hasika, travel from there into Iraq, through Erbil, and then down into federal Iraq, from Mosul down to Baghdad, all the way down through Basra, traveling around the Gulf. So very bizarre, going from, on the one hand, a war-torn Iraq, and then, you know, a couple of days later being in these mega cities like Abu Dhabi and Dubai.
So you go, where does it go? You go
southern
Iraq,
around,
Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, UAE, round the horn, down to Yemen.
Down to Yemen, so crossing part of the Empty Quarter. I knew that was an important part of it, so going by camel, sort of following in Thesiger's footsteps, into Yemen. I got thrown out of Yemen, but at least I got in, and then I had to take a bit of a detour. After getting thrown out of Yemen, I had to take a dhow across the Arabian Sea, which dropped me off in Somalia. Hitchhike across Somalia, up to Saudi Arabia again, and then following up the west coast all the way up to Lebanon.
Right, so that's the outline of the route. Come back to the beginning. Syria. We know what's going on there. We know how long it's gone on since 2011. What were you expecting to find? What did you actually find?
Syria was fascinating because I went to Syria twice. So if you can think of the sort of region, starting up in the northeast, which is Kurdish, and then on the second entry, which was from Jordan, going through Syria to Lebanon, that was government controlled,
right.
But very much on the edge of ISIS territory.
Yeah.
So, interestingly, the first night that I spent on the journey, I was pretty. I'd been to Syria back in 2010, so I knew it a little bit. But to go now, I thought, this is complete madness. But I went to this town, which is completely unaffected by the war. There was quite a few displaced people from the West that had fled to this town. But it was a really multicultural town, actually. Big Christian population.
Yeah.
Lots of Kurds, lots of Assyrians. So a mix of people. Those church bells tolling. It was a Sunday afternoon.
Surreal.
I remember thinking, this is quite surreal. And yet, most of the women were unveiled with their, not what you expect at all, wearing jeans. And it just didn't feel, it felt very European in many ways. So to go and see that side and then going into Damascus, it reminded me that actually Syria is a very secular country. It's
yes.
not, you know, the small minority of fanatics that have caused a lot of the problems there.
Well, you said that, but at the time that you were travelling, ISIS was still hadn't been knocked back as far as they have been knocked back now.
No, so ISIS still has a third of the
country. A big Wahhabist presence. There are dangers.
There are, of course. The second time I went in from the West, that was a bit more fraught with peril because we were travelling very much on the outskirts of the government-controlled areas. So
yes.
Places like East Douma.
Yeah.
It was actually, bizarre, because in central Damascus, you can sit there having there's cafes, there's restaurants, there's nightclubs, which is bizarre when you're sat there having a frappuccino and you can hear the mortars landing 3 miles away. So, but people have got used to it. You know, they are getting on with their life. Not everyone is running around terrified the whole time. Of course, that happens, but you've got to remember that this day in, day out, people just get on with their lives regardless.
Were you nervous at all, though? With regard to ISIS, because, I mean, you do have an international profile, you are well known, you've been on people's TV screens. If people are aware that you're travelling through their territory, ISIS are quite keen to put prices on people's heads where they know they have a currency.
I don't think ISIS watched Channel 4 too much to the...
You don't know that.
I grew a big beard and managed to blend in pretty well,
okay.
I think, for the most part. But you've got to be very careful. I mean, it wasn't done in any reckless way. The only way to get into Syria is with a special permit from the Ministry of Tourism in Syria. And they still have one. I mean, the weird thing is, if you buy a Syrian SIM card, or in fact, if you cross the border into Syria, you get one of those automatic text messages saying, the Ministry of Tourism welcomes you to Syria.
Wow.
Which isn't what you expect, is it, really?
That's quite weird.
But that's the reality is... Things are rarely as terrifying or as bad as they seem. And that's not in any way meant to downplay the tragedy of the conflict, but
Quite.
We have to keep these things in perspective.
In perspective. And, of course, you're not there to tell the story of the conflict, but you're walking through that territory. How do you decide on sort of modes of travel, whether to walk, whether to cycle, whether to motorbike, truck, whatever?
Yeah. Well, most of my other journeys had been entirely by foot.
Foot, exactly.
I got a bit tired of that. So I thought, for this one, I'm just going to travel by any means, but the kind of self-imposed rules were it has to be how the locals would travel or with locals, at the mercy of locals, so to speak. You know,
okay.
I wasn't going to just go to the Hertz, rent a car and just drive myself around. I wanted to hitchhike, basically. There was, of course, lots of walking involved, across the Empty Quarter Desert, for instance.
Yes.
I really wanted, just for the sake of it, to be able to walk across the Holy Lands, because I think that was an important part of the journey. So I walked pretty much everywhere in Jordan and in Israel and the Palestinian areas and Lebanon as well. So that for me was a really important integral part of it. But there's vast tracts of places like Saudi Arabia where there's just long, empty desert roads. So in that case, I would just hitchhike, often travelling by camel or donkey or whatever it took, really. So it was nice because I found that, for me, these journeys weren't really about the physical endeavour necessarily. It was more really about meeting interesting people and telling their stories.
When any journey such as this, you tend to be, and you know less in this journey, reliant upon the guides that you meet that take you across their bit of the journey. How did you choose your guides? Tell us a little bit. There's a guide who you're particularly fond of. Was it Miguel? Michel,
yeah.
Michel, sorry, forgive me. Talk us through the guides.
So, because of the nature of this journey, I mean, the sad fact is it was probably easier for me as a foreigner to do this journey than it would be for a local of any of those individual countries because of the sectarian problems and just getting across borders. So I ended up having to have pretty much one guide per country rather than being able to take people with me. Mm. So with that in mind, often these relationships were just a couple of weeks, whereas on my, you know, journeys before, like the Americas, I had Alberto with me for 6 months.
6 months, yeah, exactly.
So it was often quite condensed.
Did you have a guide on Himalayas? I can't remember.
I had two, yeah. Binod and Malang and a couple others. But no, for this, so I did get to know people, but it was slightly more superficial in some respects. But one of my favourites was a guy called Michel, who was a Bedouin nomad. I mean, it was funny because I crossed into Jordan, and I'd already been sort of communicating with this professor of anthropology at the university who was he'd offered to be my guide. So I said, okay, well, we'll meet at this cafe just on the border, and we'll plan from there. And on paper, this guy was great. He was a professor. He knew all about the history and so on. And I remember sitting down at this cafe and introducing myself and explaining the journey. And he promptly finished his coffee and left. I think there had been some miscommunication. It was because I told him I wanted to walk across Jordan. He just said, look, I'm not the man for the job. So I was stuck. I had no option other than to sort of come up with a plan B. And I was in this, it was more of a bar than a restaurant, which after Saudi Arabia was quite nice to be, you know, goes a bar. And in the corner of this bar, in the shadows, this guy was lurking there. He had long, curly black hair and this sort of goatee beard. He looked almost identical to Captain Jack Sparrow, you know, Pirates of the Caribbean. And he had this red, it wasn't a turban, it was more like a bandana. And he had black coal around his eyes. I mean, he looked like a pirate. And he was smoking a cigarette in one hand and drinking a pint of Guinness in the other. And I knew immediately that he was my man for the
it's
job.
Johnny Depp.
Yeah. So I went over to him and said, excuse me, but do you speak English? And he looked me up and down and said, why not? And so after that, I said, OK, well, I'm doing this journey and I need somebody to come with me for 3 or 4 weeks walking. Do you want to come? He finished his pint in one and said, why not? And that was it. He came with me. It was those serendipitous moments that would just made this journey. And he was remarkable. I mean, he was born and lived in a cave.
Yep.
He was completely illiterate. And yet, the weird thing was, he was still on Facebook. We're Facebook friends, and we communicate with the sole use of emojis. So it's either a thumbs up or a smiley face. So a very bizarre relationship. But he spoke quite good English, and he was remarkable. He showed me around. And the strange thing was in this part of the world that for him as a Bedou, he was great in the desert. You know, he knew he could navigate by the stars and was fantastic with camels. But the moment you get into a city, he felt very uncomfortable. Because for him, he wore the traditional dishdasha. He didn't wear, like, you know, Western clothes. And so he was kind of looked down on by a lot of the other Arabs. And it was a shame to see that divide within the society, but that's kind of just the way it goes there. And so for him, he was very much a man of the desert, but hated going into the cities.
And a very different experience from the other side of the Arabian Peninsula, where, of course, in the United Arab Emirates, the connection with traditional Bedouin culture is much stronger still, and is not reviled. It's not looked down upon.
Yeah, although it's kind of morphed into, if you're a Bedouin, you've got $100,000 Land Cruiser.
That's true.
You know, the Bedouin are actually some of the wealthiest people, and for them, the part of the tourism industry is people wanted to reconnect with their Bedouin roots and going out into the desert camping.
Some tourist camps.
But for the locals, for the Arabs, which is quite interesting.
Can we talk about camels? You can't walk around Arabia and not have a relationship with the camels. Are you a fan?
I'm a fan of the Dofari mountain camels.
Why
but
so?
Not the desert camels. Well, I tried to get desert camels to come with me across the Empty Quarter, and all of the Bedou just shrugged their shoulders and said, why on earth would you want to do that? They didn't understand, you know, for them, they've not done this in 60, 70 years.
Right.
So they don't really use that. They use their camels for racing, for showing off, as a sort of status symbol. They certainly don't go across the desert in them. Mm. Not anymore. So eventually I did guess a guy called Maruki to come with me, but he didn't have the first clue about camels, and he certainly, you know, genuinely, he brought three woefully unprepared camels. One was a female on heat, and the other three males. You know,
so an intoxicating
mix. It really kind of spoiled the dynamics of the group.
Right.
And so we didn't get very far very fast. But when we got down to Dhofar in southern Oman, I was so fed up with camels that I was just expecting things to be terrible. But they were phenomenal. They flew up these mountains over any terrain. Very, very different people. And the Dhofaris, or the Jabalis as they call themselves, whilst they are one of the original Arab communities, they don't really class themselves as Arab. So for me, it was an education to sort of learn all about the tribal politics within the region. And that was really fascinating.
And what the bits of the journey across Saudi Arabia, what did you learn about contemporary Saudi Arabia compared to the Saudi Arabia that you and I have read about from Thesiger, Frere Starr, T.E. Lawrence?
Well, Saudi Arabia was one of the biggest challenges after Yemen. I mean, Yemen was hard enough to get into, and that we ended up sort of having to sneak across the border to get into Yemen. And having been in Yemen, which is being really damaged quite badly by the Saudi Arabian foreign policy there, they've blockaded the borders. They are, effectively fueling the civil war there and so on. I kind of, before I went to Saudi Arabia, I almost wanted to dislike the place, especially because I'd seen the image that we get on the news, but I knew at the back of my mind, it can't be as bad as we always hear about. So when I got there, I was really pleasantly surprised by the welcome, the hospitality of the people. And of course, I then thought, of course, we only see one side of the story, and the stereotypes are rarely true. But Saudi Arabia was a real highlight.
Let's be clear. Are you talking about rural Saudi Arabia, away from Riyadh, away from...
Well, I didn't go to Riyadh, I stayed on the west coast.
Right.
But I went through Jeddah, which is one of the big cities. And Jeddah was like Miami.
It's stunning.
You know,
and a lot more moderate than Riyadh.
Completely. I mean, you know, there's a McDonald's on every corner.
Yeah.
You can go around in shorts and flip-flops, and a lot of the women don't need to wear the hijab.
Right.
So it was not at all what I expected. The Hejaz up in the north, absolutely beautiful landscape, and a real historical connection. That's, of course, where T. Lawrence was operating, blowing up the trains and so on. So it's generally off limits, but my guide, my sort of government-approved tour guide, was very flexible. He said, look, if you want to go and see these trains, we'll go and see these trains. So I went to see this train, which there was nothing online about the location.
Really?
I mean, I don't think anyone's been able to go there. You know, the only people that were given Saudi Arabian visas until very, very recently, if you go on a business trip, if you work in the oil industry, who bothers going to see the trains?
Absolutely.
So, you know, it was amazing to go and see this piece of history that's just in the middle of the desert, left there.
Does that camera at the back of here, does the camera zoom or not? Can you zoom onto a picture? Can we give them a treat? It's such a, I was delighted to find this photo in the book. Hold on 1 second.
It'll be on there.
There we go. If I hold it really, really still, can you zoom in on this picture here? Okay, I'm holding it still now. Can you sort of see that? That's Leveson sitting on a wrecked train that was wrecked by Lawrence of Arabia.
Exactly 100 years before, 1917.
Exactly 100 years before. Isn't that cool? And a really good reason to buy the book, I think you'll find. So that's Saudi Arabia. Let's talk a little bit about characters. I don't know if this is going to be difficult for you or not, but there is one guy that you met who had been a sniper, or was a sniper, who may have shot at, possibly killed British soldiers. Can you talk us through meeting him and your reaction to it?
So this was towards the beginning of the journey. We had to travel from Mosul down to Baghdad. The only way to do that was to be embedded with the Iraqi paramilitary units. Now, this was in September 2017 when ISIS was still very much at large. The Iraqis were on, they were on the offensive, they were winning, but there was still lots of ISIS held territory. So we're embedded with the Hashid, and these are, they're not an official government unit, they are a paramilitary unit sponsored by Iran, run by, it's basically warlords and a load of volunteers. A lot of these volunteers, you know, had been part of the insurgency against the British and American occupation. So it was quite surreal being embedded with these. For them, it was jihad, albeit against ISIS. It was a Shia versus Sunni sectarian war for them in Iraq. So I was embedded with these guys who, not until not so long ago, were shooting at British troops. But you kind of have to take yourself out of the equation, and actually they were very, very welcoming and looked after me very well, and were quite happy that they knew I was a soldier. They could, you can't hide that, you can't lie about that. Better to be open, and they were, as a result, far more forthcoming. And I was given the opportunity to meet Iraq's most famous warrior, a guy called Abu Tassin, who was a sniper, age 65, and he came from the front line and sat down next to me. I mean, this guy, big beard, a 6-foot-tall sniper rifle, you know, he looked like something off, you know, he looked like a bad guy off a movie, you know. So we sat down and he was sort of scoping me out and like, wondering what,
it's
where
this was. A useful turn of phrase for a sniper, by the way, scoping you out.
But he told me his story. He'd fought in every conflict since 1973. He'd fought against the Israelis in 73. He'd fought in the Iran-Iraq war. He'd fought in Kuwait. He'd fought in Bosnia, Chechnya, in the Gulf War in 2003, fighting in Basra against the British. And then in 2017, against the Americans in Fallujah. Anyone seen the film American Sniper? So you know what we're talking about here. And then he'd come out of retirement to fight against ISIS at the age of 65. And he told me he'd got 473 ISIS kills. It's a lot of people. So quite a bizarre conversation to have. And we were sat, as we are now, just discussing this as if it was the most normal thing in the world.
Are you talking like two plumbers would talk about a tricky plumbing issue? Are you talking about people that both understand the dynamic of warfare?
Well, the only reason he agreed to speak to me was because I told him that I was a soldier. And so he opened up. And he was a serious man, but he had a sort of twinkle in his eye, which enabled me to ask him some questions, like, what does your wife think about your occupation?
That's quite.
And he said she's very tolerant.
How is it for you, though? I mean, is this one of those incidents when you can respect the professionalism but loathe the profession?
I don't think you necessarily need to make any judgments other than, for him, he was doing what he felt was right.
Yes.
At the time. He was a soldier. You know, I know plenty of snipers in the British Army. So it's ultimately the same thing. The fact that he was shooting at, you know,
just a different uniform.
Just a different uniform. So you kind of have to take the prejudices out of it and just accept it for what it is. I mean, I suppose you can, if you believe in karma or not, but 7 days after I interviewed him, on the final day of the war against ISIS, he was actually killed by ISIS. So we found out of this. I mean, he was a very famous man in Iraq. It was all over the newspapers on the last day of the war. So, yeah. But it was a stark reminder that you can't, you know, you have to be very, very careful out there.
Absolutely. What did you find in Yemen?
In Yemen? So I'd been sat at the border in a town called Salalah on the Omani coast. And everyone had said, don't go to Yemen. It's too dangerous. You'll get killed. The people are, you know, uncivilized. You know, this was some of the Omanis in the army were like, just don't even think about going there. But of course, I had His Royal Highness's
Prince
words
Charles
eating away.
Your ears, exactly.
And I knew I couldn't ever face going back.
Do not let our future king down.
So I thought, well, there's got to be a way. And eventually, I through an introduction, an old army colleague said, look, there is one guy who might be able to help you out.
Right.
And he just so happened to be a Somali, ethnic Somali, who had been made a refugee in the 90s. He'd fled to a place called Al Mara province in Yemen, and the locals had looked after him. So he had a deep affinity.
Okay.
And then he came to London as a refugee, so he's a British passport holder. And so I made contact with him, but he lives in Oman. And he said, look, I can get you across the border. And I was expecting him to say some enormous fee. And he didn't. He said, no, you just pay the expenses, the fuel and the food.
Right.
And I thought, what's the catch? But for him, he just wanted... no journalists had been into eastern Yemen in 2, possibly 3 years.
So you're coming in from...
From Oman.
From Oman.
And he said, it's the forgotten war, it's the forgotten land. People don't know anything about what's happening in Yemen. So he said that it would be good for somebody, at least, to come in and meet the people, see what's going on there.
Right.
So we did. We sneaked ourselves over the mountains, no visas, and then we went. And again, remarkably well looked after by the Sultan. He was the son of the last king of eastern Yemen. Mm. Now, eastern Yemen used to be part of the Aden Protectorate,
right.
An old British colony, and people there had very, very fond memories of when it used to be under British rule.
Still,
they a lot of the older guys had their British passports, and when they found out that I was from Britain, they'd come waving these passports saying, when are you going to come back and sort this place out?
Oh, really?
Which isn't what we often hear in the media about post-colonialism and all the rest of it.
Quite.
But people do hark back with nostalgia to a time when... I mean, obviously, they feel very let down in recent years from foreign policy supporting the Saudis. But the point is that I was very, very well looked after, and I was given permission to travel all over eastern Yemen to the border with the Hadramat, which is where Freya Stark was travelling and speaks very fondly of. Because now that's run by Al-Qaeda. So I wanted to push west and carry on travelling overland, but I was warned by everyone in Al Mara, including the Sultan, that actually it is actually rather dangerous. He said, look, I can make some introductions, I can phone up Al-Qaeda and see if they want to host you, if you want to, but I sort of thought that might be a bridge too far. So, but just before I had to make that decision... I was recalled back to the Sultan's hotel because the Yemeni national newspaper had published an article on their front page saying that there was a British spy in Yemen trying to create an independent state.
Yes.
And when I told the Sultan that I thought that was very unlikely, he said, no, they're talking about you.
Yeah, quite.
So he said, we better leave now because they know where you are.
Quite.
They'll probably drone strike the hotel.
Exactly.
So it was time to leave. So we had to backtrack, go back to Salalah, hence
okay.
having to get this boat.
And then getting the boat across to Somalia.
So it was another week stuck in Salalah. So it was a lot of hanging around until eventually we found this guy. I mean, all of the shipping containers, all of the oil companies, they said, we're not picking up we're not picking you up to drop you off because we had to get around the coast to Saudi Arabia. And so we found a fisherman called Aladdin, who he said he'd work his magic. And he did. He found me a space on a fishing boat, a wooden dhow with a sail, very, very traditional. But instead of going around the coast to Saudi, we thought maybe we could get dropped off at Djibouti at the very least.
Yeah.
But they didn't. The boat was owned by a Somali who was probably a pirate himself.
I would say, were you worried about piracy? Because around the time you were there, the pirates were still very active on that
Absolutely.
Stretch of coast.
No, that was deemed by the Foreign Office to be the most dangerous
part of the journey.
Yeah. And in fact, the insurance company that we managed to somehow convince insure the whole trip said, we'll only let you go on that boat if there's a gun on board, which I thought was a ridiculous thing to say. I don't think there was a gun on board, but it was insured.
You just invalidated your insurance.
But anyway, we took this boat and they thought, well, at least we're sort of undercover. You know, if you're going to travel across those waters, best to go with the pirates. So they dropped us off on the coast of Somalia, and we had to sort of make our own way there. It was just me and my friend Dave, who'd come out for the jolly at this point. And that actually ended up being quite an interesting part of the journey.
Why?
Well, I'd always fancied Somalia. I don't know why, in some sort of macabre attraction to go there. But... one of my heroes is Sir Richard Burton,
Right.
And, you know, his tales from Somalia, what was then British Somaliland, and, you know, he ended up getting a spear through the face when he went traipsing across there. But for me, again, there was this attraction to go to these off-limits places, or places that are deemed to be off-limits. Yeah. So for me, there was a big disappointment of having not been able to transit Yemen, but there was definitely something, okay, well, if we can't do that, rather than just fly over, let's go across the ocean.
Sure. And of course, it's a fantastic heritage because Rambo, the French poet, worked as a mercenary and an arms dealer in and around Somalia back at the time that he was operating.
Yeah.
Did you go to Somaliland?
As well, yeah. We went to a place called Bosaso, which is in Somalia.
Which
in
is beautiful. And a great place to go.
Beautiful, but quite dangerous. I mean, it's also Al-Shabaab territory. And then through Somaliland, again stunning. And you've got these remarkable sort of hidden gems. In Somaliland, there's cave art, very, you know, for anyone to see, just in these beautiful caves. That you know, it should be a World Heritage Site.
Quick pop quiz, see if you're awake. How many of you are from London? How many of you know where Sir Richard Burton is buried? Any hands up? Yeah, Mortlake. He's in there. He has a pyramid, a Bedouin tent tomb in the churchyard of St. Mary Magdalene in Mortlake. It's just a 15-minute train journey from around the corner from here if you want to go and see it. There's a little ladder at the back, and you can crawl up, and you can see in a window at the top of the tomb his coffin on a catafalque and his wife's coffin on a catafalque.
Good Correct. Story. I went there when I got
it.
Back.
You've been there, exactly. Yeah, exactly, exactly. Okay, last question for me. We'll open it for more. Sorry, I was unaware of the passage of time. You called it Arabia for a reason. Did you find the Arabia you hoped to find? Is there anything left of the Arabia that T.E. Lawrence would recognise, or Wilfred Thesiger photographed? Does Arabia still exist as a concept? Answer that any way you wish.
Yes and no. No, there was lots of disappointments along the way. There was lots of frustrations along the way. But ultimately, yes, in that actually there's a sense of purity about the desert, about the wilderness that you encounter, about the natural world that really can't be changed. I mean, there are scars left by modernity in the empty quarter. The whole empty quarter is crisscrossed by tracks from, you know, the oil tankers going across the desert and so on. But there's still the essence there, especially when you get off the beaten track. If you go to Dhofar, you know, there are still these sort of very big forests, you know, hidden away, Yemen in particular. People still carry daggers.
Yeah.
Beautiful albeit place. Next to an iPhone, but it's they still, you know, there's still this sense of community and culture which hasn't changed in many ways. It has in places like the Gulf, you know, that's unrecognisable, I would imagine, from anything that Thesiger saw. But there are still places where you can find that hidden Arabia.
Would you recommend people to go?
Absolutely. Lebanon, Oman, Jordan in particular.
There we go. Let's open to the floor. Questions from you guys. We have 6-7 minutes. Who would like to pose the question to Leveson? We'll start with the lady here.
Hello. Lev, would you plan another expedition? Are you planning another expedition?
Am I planning another expedition? Not right now, no. For me, this was the culmination of 15 years' work. This was the ultimate expedition for me in the sense that, I don't know, I kind of feel that this brings all of the others to a natural conclusion. So I'm not planning anything expeditionary. I've got lots of other little projects on the go, and I'm writing a few more books, but I'm going to give my feet a rest for a little while.
Good
Thank
question.
You.
Gentleman there in the middle, please. Thank you, Roddy.
What advice would you give to young people wanting to do these big trips?
What advice would you give to young people wanting to do these big trips?
What advice would I... Just go and do it. I mean, you've already done it. but I would say, you know, for me, some of my fondest memories of travel were the formative journeys that I did as an 18-year-old, as a 21-year-old, and as a 22-year-old, when I just went off with no planning, no money, just a backpack, and off you go, and have a general vague destination in mind. But I mean, these days I have to kind of plan everything to the nth degree, especially if you've got a product, whether that's a documentary or a book to write, you kind of have to put a bit more thought into it. Whereas there's something about being young and having that the time you've got a lot more time when you're young to actually just not really worry about things. And so I think it's great. Just go off and travel for the sake of it and enjoy it. You don't always have to turn it into an expedition. And when you look back, it will have been an expedition. But I think just the enjoyment sense of travel is very liberating. So,
can I ask the flip side of that question? What would you advise the young traveller to not do? If there's one piece of advice you could give your younger self now about not to do?
I think sometimes you kind of, well, certainly I did, when I did these early travels, I kind of had this, I was 21 when I did this, you know, the Middle Eastern journey.
Yeah.
The next one I did after that, I was like, okay, I'm going to go and do this big epic journey, I'm going to write a book about it. And so I was kind of focused towards the achievement sense of it rather than the journey itself. And it was an amazing journey. I hitchhiked from England to India.
But I built in responsibilities,
and actually, I probably didn't need to, you know. Okay. I just wouldn't worry about the future. I think that's the advice that I give to myself. Things generally work out all right.
Nice advice. Another question from a lady here, please. Thank you, Roddy.
Would you ever entertain a beach holiday? And if so, where in the world would that be?
Would I entertain a beach holiday?
He answers, can I point out, and then I'd point out, there's a little two-day sojourn in the middle of this trip when he's on Jumeirah Beach in Dubai, right next to the most expensive hotel suite in the world, the 35,000 presidential
suite.
Well,
they gave me a tour around that. They let me have a look around, yeah. Well, it's pretty
so he has done gaudy beaches, but not necessarily on holiday. Sorry, now answer the question. Sorry.
No, absolutely. Yeah, no, I'd love to go on a holiday. In fact, I'm going to Bali next month.
Good man. Yeah. Or were you about to invite him somewhere very nice?
Yeah, if there's any tour operators out there.
Lady here, please.
Did you travel overland from Muscat to Salalah? And if so, how easy is that to do?
I did, yes. The route that I took there was I wanted to, at least in part, cross the empty quarter. So I travelled from Muscat up to Jebel Akhdar, which is beautiful. From there to Nizwa, which again is harks back to the Arabia of old, you know, the old camel market and the goat market. And then from there, that's where I got the camels and went down to a place called Haima. So when you say how easy is it, you can make it as easy as you want if you get in a car and drive it. Or you can make it rather difficult and get four very grumpy camels. I'd recommend the former, I think.
Gentleman there.
Are you running a camera all the time throughout your trips? And do you think that gets a different response from the people that you meet?
Yes, I suppose I am. So the crew, I mean, everybody thinks I have this sort of big
caravan.
Tell us a bit
about the documentary. It's a good opportunity to talk about the documentary.
One of the other things, I've got this big caravan of, like, cameramen and, like, people with those microphones and things. It doesn't really work like that, especially in regions where that just would be very difficult and people don't necessarily want to end up on TV. So it was literally me, my mate Dave, Simon, and they took it in turns to sort of rotate. So, you know, one guy would come with me for a couple of weeks, another guy would then come in and meet me, you know, in certain places with the sort of a camera. But these days, technology is great because, the cameras are getting smaller. I mean, the camera that I carry myself is just a little sort of Sony Handycam thing that you can flip out. So you don't really look like a film crew. In fact, you're just like sort of a couple of guys on a trip with a Handycam. But the quality is broadcast. So, I try and roll. You know, you've got to, if you're making a documentary, you try and film everything if it's safe to do so. Most of the time, I found that actually people are more than happy to be filmed because, especially in the more remote places or where there is conflict, because for them it's their one opportunity perhaps to tell their story.
Yeah.
And it's their opportunity to get their point of view across that they often feel is misrepresented by the media, whether in their own country or by here in the West. So, you know, places like the West Bank, you know, I wanted to show both sides of the coin. We met these hardcore Zionist Jewish settlers who were like, what are you doing here? And I explain, well, we want to talk to you, but nobody ever comes to talk to us to tell our side of the story. So it was actually quite well received, I thought.
You showed us a 1-minute clip at the beginning of this chat.
Yeah.
I have two questions. Let's start with the simple one. Why was the car only on two wheels?
So it's a sport called sidewalk skiing in Saudi Arabia. So these young lads, basically, I mean, they anywhere else, they would be professional stunt drivers.
Right.
And you've got these 17-year-old kids who can literally drive on two wheels down motorways. It's amazing.
With traffic coming the opposite direction.
Yes, they do. I mean, I had a go, but that will, you'll see. Anyway, the documentary.
And where can we see the documentary?
Well, it's a 5-part series, which has been filmed. We're in the final stages of negotiation with a couple of channels here in the UK, so as soon as I know, I'll let
you know. We'll follow you on Twitter, you'll keep us posted.
But it is going out globally as of next month.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Cool. Have you enjoyed your time with Leveson? Should we have him back tomorrow? Should we have you back tomorrow? Did you want a question? So one last rider question then, please.
I'm just intrigued why you haven't gone to Iran.
Sorry?
I'm intrigued why you haven't gone to Iran.
To Iran?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. What? Why haven't you gone to Iran?
I have been to Iran. Been there twice. I was there the summer of 2017 and made a film about it called Russia to Iran. Check it out.
Which allows me to say, madam, don't just buy this book. There are other Leveson Wood titles at the bookshop over there. Leveson will be signing just over there in a couple of minutes' time. Thank you guys for coming. Thank you for being here. Enjoy your holidays if you book them. Go and say hello to Leveson Wood.
Thank you.